The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, Happy New Year. It's a strange one, though, I have to admit. We were sitting here talking and saying, okay, we've looked at 2011. It was a time of under-the-current changes. We talked about that last week. But as we look into 2012, you've got people right now actually looking at numbers and saying, hey, the recession's over. Was that really a recession? Or these people who said it was greater than the Great Depression, was that really greater than the Great Depression? David, I don't know that we've really felt yet the default of the world sovereign system yet.
Well, Kevin, this is what's so fascinating. Coming into the new year, there is, again, sort of a bifurcation, two different views, two very different camps. One that says, look, we've got record earnings from the S&P, right. And of course, they're ignoring the fact that the majority of Dow 30 stocks have actually lowered expectations for the fourth quarter and are looking at an incredibly slower start to 2012.
Well, and 2011 was a loss year for the S&P. So for people who are thinking that this is a recovery, where was that in the stock market?
But there is, on the one hand, the sense of greater nervousness that the policymakers are really up against it. They don't have many tools to use, the ones that they've tried using. They've at least kept us above water, but we're not returning to a healthy environment. Unemployment is still high.
Right.
And those are sort of the defined concerns of one crowd. The other crowd is on the other side saying, hey, if we'll just think more positively, we'll be above this and beyond it in a New York second.
Well, but for the people who can print money, like the United States, you know, we have exorbitant privilege, according to Barry Eichengreen, and I agree with that. We don't necessarily feel the pain. We can see it on the news. I mean, let's face it, we've witnessed more social unrest last year than any time since the late 1960s.
Well, Kevin, I think this is just an important recollection. Looking at 2011 and thinking about all the things that changed in terms of political power structures,
yeah,
it was a year of almost uninterrupted drama in the news headlines. We began with, you know, this is December 2010, with the gentleman who immolated himself in Tunisia, set himself on fire in response to sugar prices being too high.
And reminds you of the 1960s. I mean, we were seeing those same images at that time.
Well, it was in Tunisia that we saw sort of the beginning of the end, if you will, for that regime. Tunisian riots followed by a new government, then Egyptian riots,
Mubarak,
and a new government, then Libyan riots, along with Western air support, a new government. You've got Syrian riots, and the government now hanging by a thread. You've got riots last year in cities like London, New York City, Moscow. Actually, you could go to countries, and throughout countries like China, Chile, Israel, India. I mean, we're talking about mass riots, even on a larger scale last year than India normally sees. There's generally 70,000 instances of civil disobedience and not full-blown riots, but protests one sort or another in China. Last year was even greater.
Think about Greece and Italy and, you know, the European countries, especially what we call the pig countries. That's not very flattering, but actually Portugal, Ireland, Italy, Spain, Greece.
Why?
You know.
Again, Kevin, if you look at 2011 and consider the political power structures which were upset, as you mentioned, you've got Greece, which had a new government put in place in 2011.
Last year. You've got
Italy and a new government put in place in 2011. You've got the same thing in Portugal. You've got the same thing in Spain, both with new governments in 2011. And it appears, Kevin, that whatever's in the air, frankly, is not very good for incumbents or, frankly, anyone at the end of a populist whip. It just depends on what issues they're focused on. And it frankly doesn't matter what your belief system is. If you're in charge during this period of stress and strain, you will be held responsible, or the finger's going to ultimately be pointed at you.
Well, I'll tell you, David, there's something that's occurred in the last week that's almost snuck under the track. You know, back in 1913, we had the passage of the Federal Reserve Act, and it was probably the greatest change in U.S. history. It changed our entire monetary system, yet we don't understand it still. You know, many people don't even understand the Federal Reserve. But what occurred during this particular holiday season, because in 1913 they snuck it under during the holidays, we have lost our constitutional rights. David, Congress voted for something almost across the board that takes away our constitutional right. They can jail us right now, any of us, without any constitutional reason.
Kevin, just to sort of give a preview, this is the kind of thing that can lead to civil war. And I'm saying that in a strange way, because if you look at the causes and the causal chains, if you will, there's many other things, of course, that have to be in the mix.
Right.
But when you take away the rule of law and the defense of individual liberties by the rule of law, Kevin, you've done something that creates an incredible amount of political and social instability and insecurity, and leaves everything on the table that would normally not be on the table in a law-driven society. What are we talking about? Just going back to what we saw in 2011, Kevin, we've seen people, by and large, act with decorum. And the idea here is that we certainly hope that frustration does not smolder into anger or any greater violence. We've seen things fairly well controlled with the Occupy Wall Street. We've seen, you know, the riots in London and Moscow. Again, we're not talking about bloodshed at this point. It's
right.
In North Africa and perhaps in your Mediterranean region, where you've seen a lot more violence and indignation. If there is in 2012 an escalation, if you will, greater anger, greater anxiety, greater violence, that would only serve to justify the entrance of police state tactics, intimidation, counter-violence, things that, you know, frankly, we hope we never see, particularly dire consequences, are even, as you mentioned, now in the mix here in the United States after the weekend signing of the National Defense Authorization Act.
Which basically says they can jail anyone, does it not, if they see them as a threat to the country, and they can hold them indefinitely.
Yeah, so Kevin, as far as I understand a presidential signing statement, which went along with the signing of the NDAA, he is able to say, under my administration, my interpretation will be different, and this is what it will be. And that essentially comes due at the end of 2012. So, yeah, if he's reelected, I don't know if the presidential signing statement is in place or if he has to actually create another one. But the reality, Kevin, is that you're changing the structure of the relationship between the governed and the governing in a very unhealthy way.
Well, and of course, it's in the name of safety. And I have to think back to what Ben Franklin said. You know, when the governing bodies have decided that safety is more important than liberty, we actually deserve to lose both. And it, does that not happen? I mean, all these things are passed on best intention, are they not?
Certainly. And that's, I think, one of the issues here is that you're really talking about a subnote wherein American citizens deemed to be a threat by the president can be indefinitely detained without any due process whatsoever.
Right.
There's no call to your lawyer. There is no court hearing. You could sit and rot in Gitmo for the next 30 years, and there is absolutely no recourse for you. That, Kevin, is expressly unconstitutional. And as such, my feeling is that every legislator that voted for it should be thrown out of office in any ensuing election. And this is the kind of accountability that needs to be appreciated between the governing and the governed. It's our job as citizens, Kevin, to voice concern. We've talked about the book Exit, Voice, and Loyalty, and it's one of those things where a citizen or any member of a body, whether it's a company or what have you, will either, out of a sense of loyalty, stay connected, will either give a voice, and that is like letting off steam, and thus remain connected to that body, or they will simply exit. Now, exit, in terms of a body of business, means that you'll no longer do business with a company that you don't like, or you'll leave as an employee because you don't feel it's a just situation. But that exit, in terms of citizenship,
yeah.
I'm not talking about a mass exodus of people, you know, renouncing their citizenship, but it's protest. And that's why I started by saying what was signed, the executive branch signed a document that, if not addressed by the judiciary, would be sort of the first in the causal chain of things, which 5, 10, 15 years from now could be civil war here in the United States.
Well, and David, when the U.S. citizens lose the defense of the rule of law, okay, they have lost everything that the Constitution grants them. And at that point, it's at the whim of the whatever leaders in power.
Right, because you're essentially having to live in fear of the arbitrary use of power against you.
Right.
And so if you lose every reason to honor the powers that be, and in turn fight because you feel threatened by them, again, you look back to the causal chain of what originally got this going, what destabilizing event, which maybe only found traction 5, 10, 15, 20 years later. Kevin, I think this is just it. The National Defense Authorization Act, Kevin, is just such a thing. And you were right to quote Ben Franklin, Kevin, because we don't deserve liberty or safety if we're willing to so superficially sacrifice liberty for something as surface-oriented as safety.
Well, now, David, where do we go from here? Because this is been passed by Congress and it's been signed by the president. I mean, when you're talking about exit, voice, and loyalty, what do? We have to speak up somehow, and the only way, actually, constitutionally, that we're allowed to speak up at this point is at the polling place and with our freedom of speech.
Well, Kevin, I think there's two places to press then. One is that the current mix of Republicans and Democrats will have, with this act, destroyed the social contract with the stroke of a pen. And I think to communicate that back to them, you know, again, just letting them know that they've lost your vote and that you're pledging monetary to support to anyone that opposes them in the next election on the basis of this issue.
David, that means throwing them all at us.
I'm okay with that. It was almost a universal consent that we needed the NDAA, even with the baggage that came with it. And this is where legislators need to, they are crafting laws that are supposed to be consistent with the Constitution. And here is something that is so grossly anti-constitutional. And again, I am hurling an insult at both the Republicans and Democrats for being so small-minded in this way.
It would be wrong to blame the Obama administration.
Oh, absolutely not. This does not rest on his shoulders. He may have signed it into law, but guess how many hundreds of people from all across this land who purport to represent you and me signed it into law first, who wanted it as an ideal. Kevin, this is why we have three parts in our governmental system. We've found two that are lacking. We hope and pray that the judiciary will see this as unconstitutional and throw it out. If they don't, then we need to make our voice heard at the polls. So as we come into this next year, Kevin, an election year, it's very important that we focus the attention of the governing on the real interests of the governed, and that is that we have our constitutional rights respected. I could care less about the issues raised by the Occupy Wall Street or Tea Party. As it concerns fiscal issues, those things will come and go with long-term business and credit cycles. As much as I care about the solvency of this country and the stability of our dollar, nothing compares in significance to our constitutional rights being sacrificed for something as silly as safety.
Well, and David, in this particular case, I know you don't agree with the ACLU very often, but the ACLU actually agrees with what you're saying right now.
They came out with a statement immediately after the signing. We're talking about within minutes of the presidential signing on the 31st, while you were toasting champagne and bringing in the new year, the president was signing something that even the ACLU said, this is an abomination in terms of our civil rights.
David, I'll tell you something. After going out and talking to the guys at Occupy Wall Street, which we've talked about on this program before, and you know, I wasn't impressed. One thing that I've seen about the protests here in America, maybe even in Western Europe, that's different as we look east, is that these people right now are focusing on, quote, capitalism, and they're blaming the financial markets, and they're blaming the big bankers, which, of course, the big bankers should take some blame, but they seem to be completely leaving out blaming the politicians. And what we saw on December 31st means we should be looking at the politicians, not capitalism.
Kevin, that's exactly right. I think what we've allowed politicians to have is sort of a free pass in 2011, at least in London and in the United States. So in the UK and in the United States, the emphasis has been much more on the money mandarins.
Right.
And I think actually we will see that change as we move into 2013, 2014.
No one, when I talked to Occupy Wall Street, no one cared anything about protesting in Washington. They just wanted to protest in New York because it must be the guys in the suits.
Kevin, I think that's a critical distinction between sort of the global protesters and the emphasis placed on politicians, the pressure raised for real political change, and the protesters here in the West, quote unquote, who are putting more of an emphasis on changes in banking, changes in fairness, changes in redistributive policies. Kevin, I think that's the real critical difference. The rest of the world seems to be going straight for the political class, and that on a wholesale basis. We would say that social unrest on a worldwide scale, not only was it seen in 2011, but that's going to continue in 2012, because you have newly enfranchised politicians who are being given the impossible task of maintaining stability in a totally destabilized world. Kevin, the great deleveraging or unwind of 50 to 60 years of credit domination in the marketplace is what these politicians are up against. And as the West takes its three steps back, the developing world, the emerging markets, they take their steps back as well. They take their lumps as well. And regardless of who's in political power today, the same question is going to be asked. What are you doing for me today by their constituents? Even the ones who put them in power, rejecting the old power structures because they didn't feel like they were being tended to.
Once again, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. McIlvaney.com. Yeah, David, sometimes we have this myopic mindset. We're just talking about constitutional rights. We have certain things that we value over here in the West. As you look east, people don't value the same types of things. And, you know, when you're giving a society that's been ruled by, say, a dictator or a tyrant or what have you, but they've been kept in order, be careful what you wish for, because the voting public may not have the kind of values that you would want to have running the country.
Well, and I think this is the illusion that we have when we think of a quote-unquote democratically elected government, that all of a sudden that's going to bring the virtues and full representation of the people. Again, bringing back this idea of the rule of law and how important that is to our democratically elected government in the United States, law is paramount. The Constitution is paramount. If you go back to Czechoslovakia, Kevin, and when Václav Havel was, after the Velvet Revolution, what was the first thing that he did? He said, I will not be in office in the next election, and I'm setting my limit. I'm setting my own term limit to 2 years. That is the time frame we have to create a constitution, something that will endure through the generations. And that is, in fact, what gave Czechoslovakia its great success.
Well, you know, I remember the Patriots, the guys, the founding fathers did the same thing here in America. You know, George Washington, they were trying to make him King George, and he set his own standard and said, no, I'm not going to do that. You don't want another king. You want transitory power.
Well, and that's the nature of democracy, Kevin, is unfortunately, if you don't have the substructure of the rule of law, you're really not talking about the greatest number of people who get to vote. You're talking about the loudest voices that get heard, and that's what becomes a representation of the people.
So, David, in the years 2012 to 2013, I mean, we may begin to wince. It may really be painful, because what we're seeing is these new democracies are really just old extremists now regaining power.
And that's certainly the case if you're looking at the Middle East, and this is where we see the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt already asserting their power, Kevin, in what was viewed as a charitable organization looking for sort of peace and generosity and everything else. Kevin, what we find is that they, in fact, are having to reassert power, reassert dominance, that all of the riots in Tahrir Square, they're happening again already, right, because people aren't having their expectations met. You're already seeing sectarian differences expressed, and while it worked last time, show up in the square, and if you're loud enough, people will respond. Now they're being loud, and the Muslim Brotherhood is saying, if you're not quiet, we're going to shoot you.
Right.
You know, this is an issue, Kevin. Again, your comment is appropriate. The new democracies, which the West is so keen on seeing enfranchised, are really just the old extremists that have received the blessing of the West because of the process, involved, quote-unquote democratic elections. That was upheld, but their priorities and their intentions were never questioned, and that should have been done at the front end.
Well, you know, David, we live in such a complicated time, too. You think of the James Bond movies. That's probably one of the best meters as to who your enemies are. Back in the old days, my son and I were talking about it. He's only 21, so he doesn't really remember the Cold War. But in a weird way, the Cold War was comfortable, David, because you just had Russians who were your bad guys, and you know, you had the two sides. But at this point, we talked about it before, there's a lack of headship, and you've got old extremists coming into power, old tyrants being either shot or taken out of power. I mean, nobody likes a Mubarak necessarily, or a Gaddafi, or a Saddam Hussein. But let's face it, from a geopolitical standpoint, things are being destabilized.
Well, and it was just a simpler world. I'm not saying it was a better world, but it was easier to make judgments and define relationships in that Cold War polarity. There was the good guys and there was the bad guys,
right,
and everybody lined up accordingly. You were a friend of the good guys, which made you a good guy, or you were a friend of the bad guys, which made you a bad guy. Kevin, so this is the point. Those who are democratically elected, and for us, that's a moral victory. We've seen democracy spread throughout the Middle East now, may in fact behold things or believe in things that we find very morally objectionable.
Well, and David, you know, let's face it, not everybody has a religious directive for world domination, but there are some of the people who are running some of these countries believe that they have, because of their God, a reason to take over the world. So, yeah, democratically elected, and you're talking about relationships based on trade or security or what have you. But they may have a motivation, David, that's far beyond what we can imagine.
Well, Kevin, I think just as an indication of that, the Al-Qaeda-linked group in Nigeria, who over the weekend was responsible for several bombings, Kevin, this is a militant group that their name translates, Western education is sin. That's the literal translation.
So it's good to know the language if you want to know what the motive is.
Well, and as long as we're talking about multicultural expression and a greater sort of globalized, homogenized world, listen, you want to be homogenized with this? Great. Western education is sin. That would include everything that isn't directly out of the Quran. So basically, we've excluded by defining the only source of education, the Quran. That's problematic, I think, for many in the West. That's problematic for for many in Europe. That's problematic for the whole world.
Right.
But we have this flashpoint, Kevin, and I think this is something that we need to remain sensitive to. Kevin, Iran, of course, with their nuclear rods and their surface-to-air missiles and their saber-rattling over the Strait of Hormuz.
And now our drone.
Our drone, yes, of course. They have our drone, which they shot down. Of course, that's not what happens. When you shoot something down, it usually ends up in 1,000 pieces.
It sure looked like it landed well to me. I mean, there's an old saying when you're a pilot, you know, any landing where you walk away from the plane is a good landing. Well, there was nobody to walk away from the plane, but you could have.
Humpty Dumpty. This would have been a magical Humpty Dumpty story where you definitely got it put back together again.
Right.
Kevin, we've got growing tensions in the Middle East, and I think this is one of the things that we'll have to explore in 2012 is the destabilization, the irony of destabilization by getting what we wanted. We chose safety and ended up with what? We chose democracy and we ended up with what?
Right.
There's probably about 10 different themes which we can explore this year, Kevin, where we thought we were saying yes to one thing, and we got something else completely different. You know, that's the same strange irony that we have with the derivatives market, Kevin. We have someone who is willing to leverage their balance sheet. You look at the average U.S. financial institution or global financial institution, and they're willing to leverage their balance sheet 10 to 1, 12 to 1, 17 to 1, 25 to 1. Massive leverage. Of course, massive profits with very little capital involved.
Right.
And they're willing to take that risk because they've taken out insurance policies to mitigate some of that risk.
Called credit default swaps.
Credit default swaps is one of the key varietals. And guess what? We discovered in 2011 that credit default swaps aren't worth the paper they're written on if you get politicians involved. Why? Because most politicians have a legal background, and if you have a legal background, you know that words are subject to interpretation. And we just discovered the reality that default is subject to interpretation. A 50% haircut is not a default as long as it's done on a quote-unquote voluntary basis. A curious loophole for the whole world of finance, which is leveraged to the gills on the basis of this insurance component, which allows them to be quote-unquote safe.
Right.
And yet again, the things that we asked for are not necessarily what they seem.
Well, and that's what I don't understand, Dave. We've talked over the last couple of years about the danger of all these derivatives sitting out there that could be triggered at any moment if we saw a default. Now, what we've seen instead of, quote, default, maybe it's default not with a capital D, but with a small d, these guys have basically said, let's don't call it default. Let's call it something else so that those insurance policies don't trigger. These guys still took a 50% haircut, but David, that credit default swap cloud is still out there, and all it would take is the right word being used, and it would still be triggered. Isn't that the case, or are the CDSs gone?
No, the CDSs are not gone. They're still there. There's very little reform that's taken place since 2008. You know, our conversation with Rick Buchstaber, Kevin, this was an amazing discovery from someone who is going before Congress and saying, we have to change this, we have to regulate the market, we have to have these things traded on an exchange, and if you don't, you have no idea what you're staring down the barrel of. Kevin, this was the question that was asked on Fox News last night, right, the interview that I did with them. They asked, 2008, reasonable problems, what do we see in 2012? And my response was, 2008 was a crisis.
Right.
But 2012, 2013...
Maybe the crisis.
The crisis.
Yeah, now that scared the commentator a little bit. You know, David even said that. David Asmund.
Well, and I think the issue here, Kevin, is that we think that we've gotten past the worst,
right,
when in fact we've changed nothing. We've changed nothing. And the things that we have changed are actually creating other areas of destabilization. And now we're talking about politics and geopolitics. But as we've discussed, negative feedback loops from one of these areas, politics, geopolitics, finance, economics, they can end up having a negative influence on all as they come back around and surprise.
Okay, now let me ask you a question, David. This is 2012 related, but it's actually bringing it down to a more personal level, okay? Because we've been talking about the state of the world. You and I are not going to change the state of the world, but we're talking to people who are sitting there going, okay, I have a family, I have a household, I have savings. Are we going to coast through 2012? Granted, 2011 was pretty turbulent. But for the most part, we've coasted through an entire year without us really feeling the effects of these things, David. 2012 is different. Now, let me ask you, from a personal point of view, for the people who are listening, they say, okay, what do I do right now? What should I look at with my finances? Gold. Let me just take it to the base of the triangle to start with, David. Gold had a good year from 1,300 to close to 1,600 by the end of the year. But It also had fallen from 1900 in the last quarter. What are we looking for on gold at the base of the triangle and maybe the rest of the triangle? Would you comment?
Sure. Well, and I think that applies specifically to the financial, and we could certainly talk about the social, political as well, because these are areas, Kevin, where, as we suggested last week, we will see extreme regime change. We're coming into a period in time where, as Frank Biancheri suggested, in the context of crisis, time gets shrunk and compressed, and the amount of things that do change in a very short period of time will shock and amaze you. 2012 and 2013, we'll see social unrest.
Right.
We'll see political change as a result of that, Kevin. But certainly when you focus on the financial element, you know, we sent out a special news alert to everyone on our email list on Friday. Gold hit the 65-week moving average. This is a technical range where gold has recovered from every time over the last 10 years. If we are still in a bull market, and we have good reason to believe that we are, then as a buying opportunity, as a place to be reallocating, as a place to look and say, okay, well, now that that asset class has been fully compressed, what can we expect? Kevin, I think we're actually standing on a loaded spring when you're talking about the precious metals coming into 2012 and 2013, again, because you have both the political change and the social unrest in the background, 2011 being a precursor in that regard. We've had a preview of coming attractions. We've seen it in sort of the fringe world, and coming to a theater near you is Washington, D.C., New York, San Francisco, Seattle, and if you're talking about Moscow, throw in half a dozen other cities. If you're talking about London, throw in half a dozen of the cities in the U.K. Kevin, where we're seeing social unrest, we'll see social unrest on a more frustrated scale, on a more out-of-control scale, and the response to that in a much more controlled and frankly, unfortunately, more violent response. Those are the issues, Kevin, which I think serve now as the structure, the undergirding for people making a decision like this. I could choose dollars, and why would I? Because I see the systems as they are being called into question. I don't know who's going to be in power next year. I don't know, even if we have a free and fair election in 2012, that they will maintain power for 6 or 12 months. Those kinds of questions will emerge in the context of an unstable social environment. I mean, Kevin, remember the last time we had this much social unrest, and you brought up the 1960s. So we have not seen that kind of social unrest in the UK. In Moscow. I mean, I don't think that's a Putin concern today or a concern for this current administration, nor should it be. Because again, I think people can and should act with the requisite decorum to pursue the rule of law, the application of the rule of law, and the healthy expectation of the governed stating their opinions to the governing in a healthy way. But Kevin, this is the context where investors say all bets are off. All bets are off on the dollar. All bets are off on the treasury. All bets are off on a healthy functioning stock market. All bets are off in terms of free trade. We can very easily see this morph into what was the summer of 1931, where a regional banking crisis in Eastern Europe became a banking crisis in London, became a banking crisis in the U.S., and what was a severe recession became a major depression. Kevin, that is the environment. Again, whether you're looking at the political, whether you're looking at the economic and financial, it is a period of extreme dysfunction and chaos. And in that environment, Kevin, people scramble for control. I look at gold being at the 65-week moving average and say, if not now, when? There is only one instance in the last 10 years where this level was breached, Kevin, and it was in 2008, the fall of 2008. And by the way, the asset did recover by the end of the year. So in spite of a 30% decline, it did recover to a 5 to 6% positive return by the end of the year.
Well, David, wouldn't you say, okay, for the person who's sitting there going, all right, there may be chaos in your life, but my life is just perfect. And don't worry about it. I think maybe it's a recovery. You guys are just crying wolf. That's all you're doing is just crying wolf. So let's just say we say, yeah, okay, that is just crying wolf.
Kevin, that's the value of the perspective triangle, because it allows you to be right and wrong regardless of the outcome.
Mm.
If it's a deflationary vortex that we get sucked into and everything gets sold down to zero, guess what you have a third of your assets in? The one thing that people want the most,
right?
Cash. Great. You're a hero. Your cash, in terms of purchasing power, just expanded a multiple, and you can buy the world for 10 cents on the dollar, making the other two-thirds of the portfolio, which may have been hit hard, inconsequential.
You have to say it's inflation.
On the other hand, your cash is worth nothing. Your equity values are succumbed to the pressure in the market of an earnings crisis. And guess what? Your physical metals in the form of an insurance policy, or your insurance policy in the form of physical metals, pay off, and it doesn't matter what happened to your cash, and it doesn't matter what happens to your equity portfolio. It becomes inconsequential. And if, on the other hand, Kevin, the Pollyannas of the world today are saying that, yes, we're in recovery, the recession is past, we have a bright future today and tomorrow. If they're right and we're wrong, guess what? You're leveraged to the upside, and a third of your portfolio will probably, over a 5 to 7 year period, make up for any losses that you've had in the cash position and in the metals position in your portfolio.
So the answer to the question that I posed a few minutes ago as to what should a person do with their own finances still doesn't change. It's a third in gold, a third on the left side for growth, and a third on the right side for cash, or at least something where you're aware of those percentages.
2012 requires that you take a balanced approach to the markets. There are these different views, as we pointed out when we began the conversation today, Kevin, of extreme concerns and extreme happiness that, in fact, the worst is behind us. When people have the facts all lined up on both sides and they happen to be opposing and contradictory, you realize that no one knows what's going to happen next.
Right.
And taking a balanced approach, a diversified approach, which we find the perspective triangle to be, Kevin, yes, I think that's the best way to approach this year. A most conservative one, certainly in light of the facts as we see them.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.